Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, go to the events page and register for that Here We Still Stand regional event in Las Vegas, Nevada. That's October 15th and 16th. You want to come hang out with Chad and me and a whole bunch of other people. It's going to be a good time. It's only $65 for you to come, and that includes your lunch on Saturday at Scott Keith's favorite restaurant. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but Scott Keith's favorite restaurant is catering the lunch. You get that included. So, I mean, if you want to come eat lunch with Scott Keith, you got to register. So go over there, get that done. Chad, we are in a passage that I would say is not a passage that you look forward to reading, and it's probably definitely not a passage that you look forward to having to break down. I mean, and if you're reading through 2 Samuel, this is one of those passages that you read it and then you try to, you know, you go take a bath or something afterwards and then try to get on with the rest of your day. I don't know that I've ever had to break this passage down in detail, and it's not one of the ones that you're like, oh, I can't wait for this one. There's some passages that you see coming down the pipe and you're like, okay, I'm excited about that one. I got a lot to say about that. This is not one of those passages, but it is one of those passages that is in the scriptures. So the scriptures did not, God did not whitewash this one out, nor did he just sort of allude to something happening. He gives you kind of more details than you're comfortable with.
It almost feels like we're back in the book of Judges when we read this chapter. It has all the markings of something that was lifted right from Judges 15 or Judges 20. And, you know, we kind of have forewarned people, right? We told them, I believe, in the last episode that, look, we're not trying to drive away any listeners, but I just want to give you a heads up. We're entering into a very dark tunnel.
Yeah.
So, you know, Nathan was not joking, or God was not joking through Nathan when he told David that some bad things were going to happen as a result of what David had done. And as we'll see, beginning in 2 Samuel chapter 13 and continuing with 14 and 15 and 16, that many of these bad things are not only on the horizon, they've actually arrived. So yeah, we finished up 2 Samuel 12 last time, and that wrapped up with the story of the conclusion to all these wars that we'd been reading about the last couple chapters, interspersed by, of course, the story of David with Bathsheba and Uriah. Now we're entering into a different narrative, for sure. In fact, you can tell the way this starts out. In Hebrew, it's a little bit more, it's a little more obvious, we might say, than in English translations. For instance, ESV starts out this chapter with, Now Absalom, David's son, had a beautiful sister. But in Hebrew, it's something like, and it came to pass after this. So it's setting the structure here for a new episode. Now, what I want to do, I think, is kind of preface this by trying to give kind of a broader perspective on where the story fits within really the framework of the entire Old Testament, which is too big an undertaking to spend a whole lot of time on, but I want to kind of give you a feel for the way this particular story fits into the past, as well as it is looking forward to the future. So if you're not familiar with what we're talking about, this is going to be the story of Tamar, who is David's daughter, the full sister of Absalom, and she is going to be tricked into entering the room of her half-brother Amnon, who is faking an illness, and he is going to rape her and then basically just cast her out of the house. And then we'll see kind of the fallout from all of that as we go on. So that's the story. Now, what I did find interesting, Dan, in studying this and kind of looking at all the connections that it has, is how many stories preceding this it's connected with. So in kind of a retrojective sort of way, a looking backward sort of way, it connects with at least three episodes from earlier parts of the Old Testament, in particular the book of Genesis. But also, in a way, this is looking forward. So it's sort of setting a template that's going to be followed, or an outline of events that's going to be followed later in Israel's history as well. Some, I'll point out more of this as we go through the story, but just to kind of give you an idea of what I'm talking about, let me give some examples here. So first of all, you think of the name Tamar, David's daughter, who's going to be the central figure in this particular story. We've heard about a Tamar before. If you go all the way back to the book of Genesis, you have Tamar. And one of the things we learned about her right away is that two brothers ended up dead as a result of Tamar. Well, now, in this particular story, we're going to have two brothers who, over time, end up dead as well. One of them is Amnon, and one of them is Absalom. There's also a series of connections, and this is probably the closest series of connections to an earlier event, between what happens in 2 Samuel 13 and what happens with Jacob and his daughter Dinah and Dinah's brothers. You'll remember back in Genesis that Dinah goes out to visit the daughters of the land. She is seized by the prince, whose name is Shechem, and he rapes her. Jacob does nothing about this, and Dinah's brothers end up tricking the whole city into having the men circumcised, and then they go in later and they massacre the entire city. So there's a number of parallels there, both with the actions and with the language of things that happened back in Genesis. And then one more past perspective here. There's also a number of connections between Joseph and Potiphar's wife. For instance, the cloak that Tamar is wearing in 2 Samuel 13 is the same cloak, same Hebrew name for the kind of cloak that Joseph is wearing back in the book of Genesis, this one that's usually translated the coat of many colors. So why are all these connections there? I mean, why all of these obvious allusions to previous events? Well, I think one of the reasons is this is the biblical way of not just showing the history repeats itself, but that to understand what's happening in 2 Samuel 13, you also need to know what happened in Genesis, because all of this is the way that over and over and over the biblical storytellers are reinforcing these truths upon us. And so all of this history is organically connected in one way or another, so that what happens with one generation is most likely to be repeated by another generation, and that's most likely to be repeated by another generation. So you can see both positively in some cases and negatively in other cases how the actions of the fathers are going to set the precedent for the actions of the sons and the grandsons and the great-grandsons and so forth. This becomes we've seen this multiple times as we've worked our way through these biblical books, where history maybe not is repeating itself, but it's rhyming. It's got this predictable pattern to it. So that's one of the things that we're going to point out in this chapter. And the other, just to kind of wrap up here with this preface, also what happens here is going to, in some ways, point forward to what happens later. So, for instance, David has sinned sexually. Well, that same thing is going to happen with Solomon later on. He's going to take all these foreign wives that he shouldn't take. David's kingdom is torn in two. Solomon's kingdom is going to be torn in two. David himself has to go in exile when Absalom stages a coup, and then later on Jeroboam has to go into exile. Finally, there is a civil war within the nation of Israel because of David and Absalom. Same thing is going to happen later in Israel's history, where you have the northern kingdom, you have the southern kingdom. David has to go in exile. Israel goes into exile. David returns, and then Israel eventually returns. So there's a sense in which David's life is sort of a microcosm of the bigger history of Israel that's coming on down the line. That's kind of a lot to just kind of throw out there at you, but we'll be looking at some more of this as we go through here. The main point I want to make is that this story is embedded within this larger past and future perspective of the scriptures. So we're going to be kind of jumping around as we work our way through the text.
Yeah, as sort of shocking as this story is, there's nothing unique about the way that any of these people are sinning. The Bible does a good job of showing you that there's nothing real special about any one sinner. They all sin in ways that are very similar. By saying something like history repeats itself or history rhymes, we're not usually talking about good things. We're talking about bad things, right? And so sin usually repeats itself generation to generation. Sin looks similar from generation to generation. that has continued until our current day. You would think that maybe we could look back and say, okay, well, these are all the sins that we've learned about, so those are the sins we won't commit. But that's not how that works. We commit all the same sins that everyone else committed before us.
Yeah, I was, while you were talking, I was thinking of a recent conversation I was involved in that was about somebody else's kind of family drama and just kind of the upheaval of the family. And while I was in the middle of this conversation, I was thinking, man, this is just sounds like it's something right out of the scriptures. You know, and we've all either been in situations like that, or maybe we're currently in a situation like that, or we have a friend or a loved one who is in these kinds of family upheaval situations. And most of the time, if you take away some of the very specific details, you can see how the broader contours of whatever's going on with this family is just basically the same thing that we've seen from Genesis onward. Yeah, so all these aspects of human nature haven't changed. So what's going on inside us, same thing going on inside David, or same thing that went inside Jacob. Human nature has not changed in that sort of way. We all have this propensity to evil that is in Genesis as well as it is in the modern day. Okay, so let's get into the end of the chapter itself. Now, Absalom, David's son, had a beautiful sister whose name was Tamar. And after a time, Amnon, David's son, loved her. Now, we'll see as we go on that love is a pretty loose term to use here. So just kind of get your family here. So Absalom and Amnon are both David's sons, but they're not full brothers. So from two different mothers. And then Absalom and Tamar are full brother and sister. Four characters so far. You got David, the father figure. You've got Absalom and Amnon, the brothers. And then you have Tamar, who's the full sister of Absalom. And it says, Amnon was so tormented that he made himself ill because of his sister Tamar, because she was a virgin, and it seemed impossible to Amnon to do anything to her. So you're getting the overall point right away. You've got this guy named Amnon who has sort of an erotic infatuation, we might call it, with his half sister. And what's he going to do about it? Well, there's nothing he can do about it. So he's sort of making himself ill because I guess this has just completely taken control of his mind. It says that he's made himself ill because of her. So this is not lovesickness. This is different. Most of us anyway have been kind of lovesick when we were younger. You know, we fall in love and that's all we can think about is this girl or this guy. Well, this is different. This isn't love. This is a sort of erotic fascination with his half sister.
Yeah, this is infatuation and obsession.
Yeah, obsession maybe is the best way to describe this. So it's a strange sort of psychology that's going to go on here too. We're going to see this play out as we work our way through the rest of the narrative.
And the reason you know that so obsession is usually irrational. When you become obsessed with something, you sort of check your reason at the door, and you're going to know that this is the case in this story as well, because a plan is put forth that if you haven't left reason behind in pursuit of the thing you're obsessed, you do not think this is a good plan.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And needless to say, even though it says that he loved her, this isn't love, because, you know, as we all know, love wills the good of another. And the only will that is at play here is that of this obsession on the part of Amnon. Amnon, by the way, I didn't mention this, but it's an important part of the story. Amnon is David's firstborn. So kind of keep this in mind. So because this is going to be another connection with the earlier stories, in particular that of Jacob. So you remember that Jacob's firstborn, whose name was Reuben, he was the one who also lost his place as firstborn because of a sexual sin. He's the one who slept with his father's co-wife or concubine. And because of that, he was excluded from being the recipient of the blessing of the firstborn. So Amnon is also the firstborn of David. So what's going to happen? Well, verse 3 says that Amnon had a friend. whose name was Jonadab, the son of Shemaiah, David's brother. So he's not just a friend, he's a cousin.
Yeah, he needs better friends.
He needs better friends. Yeah. I mean, I know you can't choose your family, so it is his cousin, but he definitely needs a better friend and a much, much better counselor. And what kind of guy is Jonadab? We're told that he was a very crafty man. Now, in Hebrew, that's just literally, he was a ish hakam ma'od. That is a man of great wisdom. This is a great point to bring out, actually, because even though the word translated here is wisdom, wisdom does not necessarily, wisdom is sort of a, can be a neutral term in Hebrew. Solomon was very wise. And if you want to look at somebody who completely wrecked his life and the life of Israel, just look at the life of Solomon. So wisdom does not necessarily imply piety or this desire to do the will of God. Yes, positive wisdom, godly wisdom, we might say, is like that. But Jonadab is a very wise guy who uses this, and that's why it's translated as crafty here, or some translations have shrewd. But it's just the general Hebrew word for wisdom, wise. So I think it's an important point to bring out that just because somebody is wise does not necessarily mean this is a positive wisdom. They can use that wisdom to do some pretty horrific things.
Yeah, I think probably most of the people that have done horrific things throughout history were probably not complete fools. Probably every dictator has been an extremely clever person.
Oh yeah, I mean that's the way they are able to accomplish the sometimes catastrophically horrific things that they do.
Like right.
Some dictators, yeah. So he's a crafty, shrewd, wise guy. And how does he display this wisdom? Well, he displays it through giving advice to his cousin. Here's the advice. He says to him, this is Jonadab saying to Amnon, "O son of the king, why are you so haggard morning after morning? Will you not tell me?" And Amnon says to him, "I love Tamar, my brother Absalom's sister." Now, that's the way it's translated in the ESV, and it's probably the way it's translated in most versions. Now, in the Hebrew, the word order is set up in such a way that kind of this is reversed. It doesn't start out with "I love." It starts out with Tamar. So I'll just translate it literally in the Hebrew. So Tamar, the sister of Absalom, my brother, I myself love. So the one that he has this supposed love for is fronted at the beginning of the sentence. So Tamar, the sister of Absalom, my brother, I myself love. So he admits to his cousin this infatuation, this obsession that he has.
Which, you know, we might be like, okay, well, that's gross and sick and all this kind of stuff. And it is. But it probably doesn't hit the same way back then. I mean, you got to remember, you know, Rebecca is super irritated with Esau because he won't marry someone in the family, you know, or this kind of thing. So that part probably doesn't hit as icky as it would hit us. Still probably not something that is going to get sanctioned. I mean, he's not going to go to his dad and say, "Hey, can I marry my half-sister?" It's probably something that David's not going to allow. I guess what I'm saying is that initially hearing this, him saying this, like if somebody said that to you, you would be like, "Well, dude, you gotta go get help."
Right. Yes.
It probably doesn't have that effect.
No, it doesn't. In fact, wait a minute. We have. I don't know if people are aware of this detail about Abraham and Sarah, but it is worth mentioning here. Abraham and Sarah were half brother and sister.
Right. Right.
So I mean that's a detail that Abraham brings out the second time that he gets caught telling a king that she's his sister. He's like, "Well, you know, actually she's my half sister." It's what he tries to justify his lie. So what to us as modern people often kind of kicks in this yuck factor. Like, "Oh, that's just this gross, you know. Why would you be in love with your half sister or half brother?" Well, back then that yuck reflex probably is not going to kick in.
No.
Because you know, it was a lot of intermarriage of first cousins. There were marriages between uncles and nieces. I mean, this was not unheard of at all. In fact, it was very prominent in not just the ancient world, but up until relatively modern history. Okay, so That's what he says to Jonadab. What's Jonadab going to recommend? Well, here's what he says. He comes up with a very shrewd plan. He says, lie down in your bed and pretend to be ill. And when your father comes to see you, that is David, say to him, let my sister Tamar come and give me bread to eat and prepare the food in my sight that I may eat it from her hand. So that's the advice. Now, notice that Jonadab does not kind of, he kind of leaves it hanging, right? He kind of gives it, here's the idea. He's giving advice that sets the scenario for what Amnon can then do.
There's two things here. One, based on the stuff that we did mention, I mean, like if he really, really, really loved her, he could go and try to convince David that this is the case and that he wanted to marry her or something like that. Now, of course, we would be horrified by such a thing. But as we stated, like something like that is not without, you know, is not outside the realm of possibility.
Yeah. It's against Mosaic law, but that doesn't mean that David wouldn't still say yes.
Right. And so, or at least, you know, you could have attempted. Like, there's nothing. He doesn't even bring it up. So he's not even going to bring this up to David. The second thing is this sort of advice feels like it's missing one thing to be pulled right out of the book of Judges. And that's, okay, here's what you do. Here's the plan. You're going to pretend to be sick, and then you're going to say, I need my sister Tamar to come in and, you know, cook me food in front of me, and then I'm going to eat it from her hand. The only thing missing from this is him then saying at the end, and I think this is sort of implied, even though it's not stated, is him saying, and then do what is good in your own eyes.
Yes, precisely.
I mean, this is like the unstated thing, right? Like here's the setup, and then you do whatever you feel like you should do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure in kind of the tone of voice that he said this, that would have been the implication. Yeah. So that's the advice. Amnon evidently thinks that it's great advice because that's precisely what he does. He lays down and he pretends to be ill. And no doubt word gets back to David. So the king comes to see him. And Amnon says to him, he says, please let my sister Tamar come and make a couple of cakes in my sight that I may eat from her hand. Now, in the Hebrew, the word translated here as cakes could be translated. I'm reading from Robert Alter's translation here. A couple of, he translates it to heart-shaped dumplings. Now, I don't know where he got the dumplings from, but the Hebrew definitely does have this heart language embedded within it. So a couple of heart-shaped cakes, a couple of heart-shaped pancakes, whatever heart-shaped food he wanted. Now, why would he specifically say that? Well, you know, is there a hint here of some sort of sexual overtone? Is it just kind of implied that, you know, my heart is weak and these cakes, almost in a sympathetic sort of way, will strengthen my heart? Who knows? But it is kind of hard to ignore the fact that they're heart-shaped. Now, don't get kind of Hallmark Valentine things in your mind, because that's not the way the Hebrew works here.
I don't think in Israel they were drawing hearts the way that we do on Valentine's Day. I think a heart shaped is more like an actual shape of a heart here, a lump.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so anyway, that's what's going on with the Hebrew there. These heart shaped dumplings, pancakes, cakes, whatever. That's what he asked, so that I may eat from her hand. Now, I guess David, upon hearing this, suspected nothing. There's really nothing that he could necessarily read into this. It might strike us as rather odd that he would specify his half-sister to be the one who would come and do this.
Why should he come make it in front of you? It's weird.
And right? why should she? I mean, I'm sure there were many other daughters of David, not to mention all of the servants that could have done it. Kind of come and done this.
But yeah, if you want some cakes, just ask for some cakes. We'll have some brought in.
Yeah, why does it have to be her? Now, I don't want to impute any kind of motives to David here, because I don't think we have justification for that. But it does seem odd that he didn't, at least we have no evidence, that he stopped to wonder why this particular request, which seems extremely odd to us, would have been made by Amnon.
Well, I mean, and you know, this is not something you would, what was about to happen is not something, unless you had reason, apparently David doesn't. If you don't have reason to think that this is about to happen, this is not something that you're thinking is about to happen.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And Amnon is David's firstborn. Probably because of that, he shows him deference. Amnon wants his sister Tamar to come and do a little baking in front of him because he's not feeling well. Well, then I guess that's what I'll do.
I mean, this sounds a little similar to when Isaac wants a meal prepared and he knows that his son prepares it can prepare it a certain way. Maybe David's just thinking he must really love the way that she bakes those cakes. I guess she's got the recipe that he likes.
Right. Yeah. So David goes to sent home to Tamar and says to her, go to your brother Amnon's house and prepare food for him. So pretty straightforward message. So Tamar, and we're assuming at this point, unsuspecting of any kind of sinister plot, she goes to her brother Amnon's house where he was lying down. And she prepares the meal. She took dough. She kneaded it. She made these cakes in his sight. She baked the cakes. And she took the pan and emptied it out before him. But he refused to eat, at least at first. And Amnon says, send out everyone from me. So everybody goes out of the room. And then Amnon goes on to say to Tamar, bring the food into my chamber that I may eat from your hand. Now, it's pretty hard for me at this point not to pick up on the fact that we've got, from the narrator's perspective, as he's telling this kind of this overlap between eating and sex, kind of these, that this is sort of a metaphorical blending of these two particular things. So what he says to her, he says, hey, bring the food into my chamber, that is my bedroom, that I may eat from your hand. So Tamar took the cakes that she had made and she brought them into the chamber to Amnon, her brother. But when she brought them near him to eat, he took hold of her. He grabbed her and said to her, come lie with me, my sister. Which is, apart from all the other kind of evil of this story and weirdness of this narrative, to address her as his sister,
yeah,
in the same breath in which he says, well, it's translated, come lie with me. We would, in English, we would come out more straightforwardly and say, hey, have sex with me, my sister.
Yeah.
Just, there's so many weird things about this particular story.
Yeah. It's weird. It's weird that he's not trying to diminish that fact. Right.
So yes, that's the weird part. Yeah. Right. Why call her that? Why not call her by her name? Anything but the very word which denotes this familial connection that they have. By the way, this come lie with me is the exact same Hebrew expression that Potiphar's wife says to Joseph. So this is one of these intertextual connections that we have between this particular story and what happens with Joseph and Potiphar's wife. Now, of course, the connection between some of these stories is antithetical, that it's setting up the opposite reaction, because when Potiphar's wife says this to Joseph, Joseph says no, and he's able to get away. He's able to flee. But of course, we're about to see the opposite happens here. So he says, come lie with me, have sex with me, my sister. She answers, no, my brother. Now, I think in her mouth, my brother is a perfect thing to say. She's reminding him of who he is. Now, my brother, do not violate me, for such a thing is not done in Israel. Do not do this outrageous thing. As for me, where could I carry my shame? And as for you, you would be as one of the outrageous fools in Israel. And then she goes on, therefore, please speak to the king, for he will not withhold me from you. So she says a lot, trying to, of course, on the one hand, dissuade him from doing what he's doing. And whether she was right that the king wouldn't withhold from him or not is kind of beside the point. I suspect at this point she's grasping at anything that's going to hopefully make him back off.
Yeah, well, I mean, she's bringing up sort of what I had brought up earlier, which is, I mean, if this is something you really want, there's the better way to attempt to get it is to go talk to David. Now, is that going to work? We don't know if that would have worked or not. But it's certainly the argument that she's making is that, hey, this is not the right way to do this because the repercussions of this are going to be terrible for both of us.
Yeah. By the way, this speech from Tamar echoes many of the same words that we read when we cover the story of Dinah back in Genesis and her rape, because when it says don't do this outrageous thing or you'd be as one of the outrageous fools, the Hebrew behind that is Nabalah. That's used to describe what was done to Dinah when she was raped. So it was sometimes translated a scurrilous thing. And almost every time that it's used, it denotes something which is so horrendous and is often a sexually horrendous act that it must be addressed in some way. So this is the same word that was used in reference to the rape of the concubine, the Levite's concubine toward the end of the book of Judges. So this outrageous thing, this scurrilous thing, she says, don't do that. And then verse 14 says that he would not listen to her. Then we have a series of three Hebrew verbs in a row, which indicate the precipitous and violent nature of what he did. He would listen to her, so he overpowered her, or he was stronger than she was. So he overpowered her, he violated her, and he, literally in the Hebrew, he lay her. When Hebrew talks about sex, sometimes it will say that someone lay with someone. The with here is not in the Hebrew. It's a direct object. He lay her. That's kind of the Hebrew's way of pointing to the violent graphic nature of this. So, of course, we would translate that he treated her violently or that he raped her and he lay her. Same language, by the way, that is used in the rape of Dinah back in the book of Genesis. Now, at this point, we have to piggyback off of what I just said with regard to Genesis. If you remember, after Shechem raped Dinah, it says that he loved her. Now, again, this was an infatuation, but after he seized her and violated her and lay her, then Shechem, we're told, loved Dinah and wanted to marry her. Now, here we have, which of course is a psychotic kind of craziness. Now, here we have the opposite. We're told in verse 15 that Amnon, so after he does this to her, after he rapes her, Amnon hated her with a very great hatred, so that the hatred with which he hated her was greater than the love with which he had loved her.
Yeah, so that is a wild way of saying that, isn't it? I mean, it's really trying to get across to you that this irrational obsession that he has completely flipped, and now he absolutely disdains her. It makes you believe that Amnon is a fairly unhinged person.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he's deranged in, I mean, the same way that Shechem was, but not the same way, but Shechem was deranged too, but Amnon is deranged just in a different sort of way. Now, once he has acquired, well, he treats her like a thing, like an object. So once he has acquired this thing, this object, then he immediately has the opposite reaction. He's like, he's done with her. So what he thinks that he wants, once he has it, he then treats as garbage afterward and just kind of throws her away. This is a very, it's a different sort of biblical verse to read. We don't have a whole lot of verses like this where it's almost a psychological treatment of this reaction on the part of Amnon, where he flips completely from supposed love or infatuation to this hatred of the girl. And so Amnon says to her, before he said, come lie with me, and now he says the exact opposite of this. He says, get up and go. So come lie with me, and now get up and go. She says to him, no, my brother, for this wrong in sending me away is greater than the other that you did to me. Now, it might be kind of hard for us to wrap our minds around that. So she's saying that to send me away, having done this to me, would be worse than what you've already done to me.
What it seems like is being said here is that it is sin on top of sin, right? So it's compounded. And what's happening is that by sending her away, he is sending her off to go and deal with this on her own. This is not that big a deal to him. At this point, he doesn't believe that this is something that is some life-altering event. He just wants to get rid of it. But this is not the case for her, and she knows it. And so what he's doing here is sinning greatly against somebody and then telling them to go deal with that sin on their own.
Yeah, he's violated her as a virgin, and now he's placed her in the kind of social situation where she is basically not going to have the kind of life that any Israelite woman would have expected at this time.
Yeah.
So she's going to have to, as you say, she's going to have to deal with this on her own.
Yeah, and not being a virgin at that point was a much bigger deal than obviously it is today.
Yeah, she would probably be just kind of a social pariah, as one commentator put it. She would not be married, and so she's going to have to bear what was done to her as the victim for the rest of her life.
Yeah.
And Amnon treats her as if that doesn't matter at all. All that matters is that he got what he wanted, and now he hates her, and he's going to cast her out of the house. So Amnon says to her, get up and go. She begs him to not do this, but he wouldn't listen to her. So he calls the young man that is a servant who served him, and he says to her, ESV has put this woman out of my presence and bolted the door after her. It's even more kind of grotesque in the Hebrew. He says something like, put this thing, or the woman is not in the Hebrew. So it's like, put this creature or put this thing out of my presence and bolt the door after her, as if she was just kind of this dangerous thing that needed to be locked out of the house lest she come back in. She was wearing a long robe with sleeves. Now, this is the Hebrew expression that is translated in the King James in Genesis as the coat of many colors, the kenotet pasim. It only occurs here and in the story of Joseph. So Tamar and Joseph are the only two individuals in the entirety of Scripture who are described as wearing a ketonet pasim, a long robe with sleeves, or if you want to go the King James route, the coat of many colors, which of course is an explicit tying together of these two particular stories, because just like Joseph was abused by his brothers, so now she has been abused, sexually abused, raped by her half-brother, and basically thrown away, just like the brothers of Joseph threw him away. And we're told that this was how the virgin daughters of the king dressed. So the servant put her out, bolts the door after her. Tamar puts ashes on her head, tore the long robe that she wore, laid her hand on her head and went away, crying, weeping aloud as she went. Let me kind of wrap this up here. Her brother Absalom, that is her full brother Absalom, said to her, has Amnon, your brother, been with you? She doesn't answer. We're assuming there's no recorded answer. We're assuming she nodded or said yes. He tells her to hold her peace. He is your brother, Absalom says. Do not take it to heart. Now, lest you think Absalom is just kind of trying to sweep this under the rug, we're going to find out more about what he does later on. I suspect at this point he's just telling her kind of to keep quiet about it, that he's going to take care of it. And then to wrap up this particular section, says Tamar lived a desolate woman in her brother Absalom's house.
And this is sort of the why she says this sin is greater, because this is now the situation that she's in.
Yes, precisely. So she's going to be this desolate woman in her brother's house, presumably then for the rest of her life. Now, there's a whole lot more to this story. We've just kind of gotten started on this. We're going to hear next time about how David reacts, how Absalom, after a period of time, is going to seek his revenge. There's a whole lot more that we're gonna get to. And you know, I know we told you this is a hard story, it's a dark story, it's a terrible story, but it is kind of the beginning of this snowball that we're gonna see as time goes on, where it's as if David's sin, Bathsheba and Uriah and everything else, it's as if these are exaggerated and repeated and compounded in the lives of his family as we go on. I mean, David sinned sexually, Amnon sinned sexually, David sinned with a beautiful woman. Now Amnon has sinned with this beautiful woman who is his half-sister. And there's going to be a lot of other kind of repetitions and expansions of David's sin as we go on with the rest of the story.
Yeah, it does seem that Absalom is going to, this is the maybe the beginning of Absalom really not respecting David at all. We'll see that in the reaction next episode. But just the fact that Absalom immediately asked his sister, is this what happened, lets you know that Absalom probably suspected something that David was not wise enough to catch on to. It seems unlikely that Absalom would have sent his sister in there. Absalom seems like he knows that there was something going on here. David was at the very least oblivious to it. And this is the first thing that sort of weakens David's standing in Absalom's mind. Next episode, we'll get to David's reaction, which will not help that at all.
No, David. David will be perhaps not a replica of Jacob and his reaction to Desiree, but will be pretty close. Yeah. So I didn't want to get there in this episode because there's so much more to talk about. But hang with us. We'll come back to this, and we'll see the rest of the story as it unfolds. And we'll also try and set this within the broader perspective. This is terrible. This is dark and sinful, but in a crazy, unexpected sort of way, God is going to kind of use all of this history to keep things advancing toward the ultimate goal.
Yep. All right, Chad, I will see you next week.
All right. See you then.